KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Because the nature of our military has changed. We have these things called aircraft carriers where planes land on them.
I have a deal for the president, a deal that I don't believe he can refuse, and I hope he doesn't.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. That was Donald Trump offering a deal the president can't refuse. We'll talk about that later. And you also heard President Obama and Governor Mitt Romney from the debates. We'll be getting to all those national stories later. But first, we're going to start a little local with our journalist roundtable. Joining us in the studio is Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times.
Good morning, Katie.
Knut Berger, editor-at-large of Seattle Magazine and Mossback at crosscut.com, also the author of Pugetopolis and Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. Thanks again for coming in.
Yeah, good morning.
2 days in a row, Knut.
That's right.
Eli Sanders is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and associate editor at The Stranger. Thanks for coming in.
Nice to be here.
And C.R. Douglas is political analyst for Q13 Fox News.
Thanks. Good morning.
For coming in as well. So let's start with the question of the drones. We talked on the show yesterday to Sean Whitcomb and Jennifer Shaw from the ACLU about the drones. Seattle police last night invited the public to come see the drones and ask questions. But many of the people who showed up were protesting and yelling so loud that the police had a hard time talking about anything. There were references screamed about 1984 and the like, and Eli Sanders was there. So what happened?
This was quite a community meeting. Like you were saying, the Seattle Police Department officials who came to introduce the community to the drone were introduced themselves to protesters who had no intention of letting the police drone on about it. So the police started with their PowerPoint explaining the drone and how it's going to be used and how it's not going to be used, and were very quickly interrupted by people all over the room who were shouting about this. You're right, shouting about Orwellian tactics and police state references and fascism. And at the bottom of it is a lot of anxiety and concern about what this drone will do, not only now, but eventually. When capabilities of drones that police departments can use become even better than the capabilities of this little drone, which was on display, which was...
How big was this little drone?
This little drone is like as big as a medium-sized pizza box. And it's got three helicopter-like rotors that lifted off the ground. They demonstrated the rotors spinning at the forum, and the spinning sound was totally drowned out by booze. They didn't let the thing lift off because I think they didn't want to risk anything going wrong.
It's basically a model airplane.
Well, it's a very, very fancy model airplane, and it's got a camera mounted beneath it, and it's also got some sort of heat sensor. There was references to, it having heat-seeking something on it, and the police officers are like, no, heat-detecting. They want to clarify between, heat-seeking missiles and heat-detecting drone. But again, in there, you see the concern that these things provoke. People were really worried about the drone flying through their backyard.
Mm-hmm. Hearing about the drones, the thing I was thinking of, I live near Seward Park, and so Andrews Bay and the lakes and all that. And many a time in a summer, unfortunately, there are helicopters above because someone has fallen out of a boat, has gone swimming for too long, that kind of thing. And so the only thing that when I hear about drones that I'm thinking, well, maybe could possibly a drone go find the missing person in the lake.
And that's one thing that the police definitely emphasize. They say we want to use this for search and rescue. They also say that it's not going to be in hot pursuit of anyone. They're not going to use it. And, I think you have to take this with a grain of salt. They're not going to use it, at least initially, in pursuit of anyone. So it's not, they say, going to be flying through backyards chasing someone who's leaping over fences. But it does have a camera mounted on it, so it could be used for search and rescue. It could be used, they say, for hazmat situations, for someone barricaded in an apartment, I guess I would imagine, things like that. What's, I think, very interesting and is going to play out locally over the next months or maybe even longer is the restrictions that are going to be placed or not placed on these things. The police department was handing out their proposed rules and regulations, but the council may end up having a say. They could, and I think the ACLU wants this, they could institute an ordinance, a law that restricts how the police could use these things, or I think some people would want them to just ban them outright in the city of Seattle. I mean, some of the protesters there were saying, we can't trust you to use the weapons that you have. Why should we trust you to use this? The other appeal that will be made, I think, at least according to people who are there, is directly to the mayor, who is ultimately the head of the police force, to ask him to place some limits on these things. And, you know, all the while, the police department is trying to say, this is not as scary as you think it is.
That's Eli Sanders. CR, you want to add to that?
Well, kudos for the police department for having a public forum soliciting public input. I mean, these aren't being used yet, and they say they want to hear from the public. So these protests could kill the program. I can't imagine a worse time for this to be coming up when trust in the police department is at an all-time, you know, low, to add this to the mix and worrying about surveillance video, who has access to it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I heard Sean Whitcomb defend it yesterday on the radio, and it strikes me to have pretty limited use. I mean, he was talking about, you know, a hostage situation that might be happening on, you know, the fifth floor of a building, and you would need the drone maybe to go up and
take the elevator, of course.
Take a look. I mean, I suppose you can argue that there are instances where you'd need this and to find the body, but I guess it's going to take more convincing for the public to feel like, hey, we have this enormous number of incidents that are either putting police in jeopardy or we're not finding bodies that we should, et cetera, that this drone would really solve. It feels like it's a very, very small number of cases.
And you're absolutely right. The people who were shouting at the meeting brought up John T. Williams. They brought up the Justice Department investigation. They made exactly the point that CR is raising.
Do you think that a city ordinance like the ACLU wants would help?
Well, I think you can always figure out a way to you know, have a 25-page, you know, list of guidelines for when the tape is used and which direction the camera is pointed, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It strikes me as a lot to go through and a lot of sort of policies to create for not much payoff.
Johnny?
I had two thoughts about this. One was, what is this? You know, there's this idea that a lot of things are being videotaped more and more, as we had with many of the incidents. So, you know, somebody has an iPhone and they're taping the interaction between the police and somebody who's not getting along with the police. And then there was that proposal to have cameras on police uniforms, another version of this. And just a sort of really quick personal thing, one time I was driving over Blewett Pass a little faster than maybe I was supposed to pass another car. And I get pulled over by the state patrol, and when he comes up to my car, he begins his little speech to me, which is that, my name's Officer blah blah, and you're being recorded on a camera, and he points to a camera somewhere off the side of the road. And I thought, well, what are you telling me that for? Do you think I'm going to behave differently? I'm going to start screaming or something? So anyway,
who are you, a county council person?
Well, can you or Eli? But did you want to add to that?
I was going to say quickly on the question of ordinance versus guidelines. I mean, I think it actually could become a very important question, because guidelines that the police department establishes for itself are just that, guidelines. And they can have, you know, a 40-page list of when you point the camera this way and what situation you use the drone and don't. But those guidelines could theoretically be set aside. An ordinance is different. It's more ironclad. It's a law. The police have a very firm barrier as to what they can do and cannot do. And I think that's why people who are concerned about the drones are more interested in an ordinance.
Knut Berger?
Well, I was just thinking, in a town with so many activists and so many aeronautical engineers, it would seem like you could create a citizen drone that would monitor the police drone and at least have some kind of, you know, with GPS and an iPhone app or something, some way to monitor how this thing is actually being used and track it. You could have a little drone watch, you know, central kind of room. So,
and none of us would ever drone on either.
So. The Office of Professional Accountability could have a drone fly behind the police drone.
Exactly.
And eventually we won't be able to fly a kite anymore, because there'll be so many different drones flying around. Obviously, it seems like the police are inviting conversation because they're trying to take away the fear factor of it and also appear transparent. But do you think it would have been better for them not to really bring it up?
No, I think it would have been worse. And they say that they expected, you know, a pretty loud outcry. I think my sense of what they were trying to do was give vent to all of that, let people vent and see if just the act of venting would be enough. This isn't the only community meeting they're going to have. I think they said something about four more or something like that being scheduled. So that will be really interesting to see how those go in different neighborhoods, and whether after people are allowed to vent about this, they feel mollified, or whether they feel more rallied to the cause of placing restrictions around these drones.
C.R. Douglas, do you have something to add?
Well, I mean, a couple of years ago, they decided to put surveillance cameras up in Callender's Park and maybe one other park, and that turned out to not work. They didn't yield a bunch of crime, you know, on tape, and also, but generated the problem of what do you do with all this video and who gets access to it and all the
rest. And they have that problem because they have video on police cars. And sometimes it captures everything, but then there's the whole issue of the storage and who has access and all that good stuff.
And all of this came up last night. Who is going to be able to watch the video that the drones shoot?
I was just going to say, you know, part of the legitimate concern here is the way the police department, not just our police generally in our country, have becoming more militarized. If technology shows up in the military, it eventually filters down to local police departments. If you look at the kinds of helmets they wear, the body armor, the weapons, the tanks, especially since 9/11 with terrorism, there's been this kind of, it's not a trickle down, but it's a conscious movement to sort of militarize the police. And of course, drones are a concern, you know, with what our own government is doing with drones. Even government officials who supposedly believe in civil liberties and things like that, what we're doing. And I think there's a very legitimate concern over and above just being concerned about the local police with the effort that what's happening what's happening in Afghanistan is eventually going to be happening in the streets of America at some point in terms of the technologies and techniques that are being applied to policing.
And this is exactly the doomsday scenario that was prophesied by the protesters last night. I mean, they brought up Afghanistan and Pakistan and what predator drones are doing there, and then painted a picture of drones here in Seattle doing the same thing on behalf of the police. Now, the police department was, I mean, they don't even want to use the word drone, but I don't think they're going to succeed on that part of their campaign. They want to call this an unmanned aerial vehicle, which it is.
They should call it a model airplane.
Right. But again, there's concern that the police department, because it is a technology that's basically evolved from military technology, that it will be used in the same way that the military uses it. Now, the police say no.
Will you be attending the further meetings, Eli?
We'll see. I mean, this was quite
Stranger
a forum.
Drone reporter, Eli Sanders.
This was quite a forum. We actually, there were, Brendan Kiley was at the forum also, and I think he has a report up on Slog now or soon about it. So I imagine we will definitely be following this issue going forward.
Well, let's take a break and then move on to other issues. We're reviewing the news of the week with Joni Balter, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, and C.R. Douglas. And you, if you want to give us a call at 206-543-5869, that's 206-543-KOW. We'll be right back.
A lot of people see Thornton Wilder's Our Town and see their town.
I grew up in a little town in North Carolina, population 800. When I read Our Town as a teenager, I was positive the play had been written about Waxhaw, North Carolina.
Wilder's biography, Penelope Niven, and How a Classic Came to Be, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That story and much more tomorrow morning between 5 and 9 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information.
Support for KUOW comes from For Your Eyes Only in Wallingford, presenting the Fall Eyewear Collection by LaFont on Saturday, November 10th, 12 noon until 5 p.m. Located in Wallingford Center and locally owned for over 26 years. Details at foryoureyesonlyoptical.com.
We have clouds and showers and 50 degrees in the University District. We're expecting a high today in the low 50s. Forecast calls for clouds and rain the rest of today. Same for tonight and tomorrow. Tonight's low in the upper 40s. Tomorrow's high in the mid 50s.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell sitting in for Steve Scherr. Well, I'm joined with our reporter roundtable, Joni Balter, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times, Knute Berger, editor-at-large of Seattle Magazine, Mossback at crosscut.com, Eli Sanders, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, associate editor at The Stranger, and C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News. And I wanted to touch just very briefly about the selection of Merrick Bobb as the independent monitor overseeing the police department. Earlier this week, Mayor Mike McGinn expressed his objections to appointing Merrick Bobb, who's a Los Angeles police consultant, to the role of independent monitor overseeing police reforms as part of the agreement with the Department of Justice. He said that his objection was due to the fact that Bobb's nonprofit helped write the Justice Department report that found biased policing and a pattern of excessive force in the Seattle Police Department. So, CR, what did you think of Mayor Mike McGinn's objection?
Well, I think it's got some merit, although, you know, ultimately council members didn't believe it was a problem or a conflict, and they forced the choice on him. It is his second loss in the last couple weeks when it comes to sort of police reform. He tried to get the OPA director reappointed. The council shot that down. He tried to sort of get one of his choices in for this monitor for the Justice Department. The council shot that down. So this is two examples of the council flexing their muscles and the mayor having to back down. I don't think it's you know, I don't think who the Justice Department monitor was going to be a huge issue. They were all pretty qualified, but the council wanted Merrick Bobb and they forced it.
Yeah, they voted 8-1 in favor, with Mike O'Brien being the one dissenting vote. Do you think backing down was the right thing for Mayor McGinn to do?
He had no choice. I mean, it was an 8-1 vote, and you lose.
So is this a big defeat for him, or just a...
I think internally he feels... I'm sure he feels frustrated that the council shot down, again, two of his suggestions when it comes to police reform lately. I don't think the public's particularly tracking this. I don't think these are the big defeats, you know, that we think about for this guy. He's got other sort of issues to worry about.
All right, well, let's move on to the fast approaching election. A lot of people have already voted, and or they've decided how they're going to vote on a lot of issues. But the one place where we're seeing people wavering is still about Inslee and McKenna for Washington governor. Why do you think people just can't seem to decide about this race?
You know, it's funny. In the summer, I was out talking to voters, and it was surprising to me how many voters hadn't decided on Obama versus Romney at that point, because this was like July or early August. But they really weren't up to speed on the governor's race. So it's been sort of a slow get to know both candidates situation here. There is one very interesting phenomenon going on in this race and nationally, and it's called female voters. They have been bopping around. You know, there was, I think I mentioned it last week, presidentially, before the first presidential debate, there was an 18-point gender gap. What do I mean? That is the difference between men and women's support for any given candidate. And at that point, before the first presidential debate, women were, and this is the traditional, favoring Obama, and with men on the other side for Romney. But by the morning of the second debate, the gender gap had gone away. Well, here in Washington, Stuart Elway released his poll this week that showed, and this had to do with, well, first of all, it showed McKenna ahead for the first time, but within the margin of error. But what it also showed was this self-identification of women voters had really changed. So in September, and I don't know if this is really poll-worthy or statistically valid or anything like that, but in September, 52% of women had identified themselves as Democrats. But that number had dropped in October to 39%. So something is there is a battle royale right now for female voters, no doubt about it. The ads are geared to them. You know, you can look at the Rob McKenna ads and you would conclude that he doesn't have any male children. But all the candidates are talking to women voters because, and I just heard this coming here, that younger women are the ones who are registering a lot, you know, here in the final days of in-person registration. Something interesting going on.
That's Joni Balter. Eli?
Well, speaking of battle royale, there was a rally royale at the Space Needle yesterday morning, I guess, where women who were trying to say that McKenna has been given a bad rap on reproductive rights issues by the Inslee campaign showed up to hold a press conference declaring that, you know, only a few steps from every single TV station in town, so good strategy. But Inslee supporters showed up in force also and stood behind them and held placards and chanted, not interrupting, but chanted in the in-between quiet periods. And you could see how important it was for both sides to reach female voters in King County. Not just female voters, but female voters in King County, because remember, King County is central to the electoral strategy for Rob McKenna, peeling off votes here. Another thing that may be affecting female voters, and I think probably all voters, is the question of how similar the candidates are in terms of saying they're not going to raise taxes and they're going to spend more money on education. And there's a blog post that just went up at The Stranger that David Goldstein actually did that I think is very interesting, that addresses this complicated property tax swap issue that's come up in the campaign that McKenna supports, and also how McKenna is going to fund his billions more for education. And Goldie believes he's discovered that McKenna's funding for education, the billions more he's promising, actually is just an accounting trick, as he calls it, but moving the property tax swap money that has gone to the state for education, or counting that as billions more. Essentially, what the property tax swap is doing is shifting levy money from local jurisdictions to the state. So if you shift, you know, $1.7 billion, I think is what the amount is, to the state to spend on education rather than local jurisdictions, the state is technically spending 1.7 more than it was before, but the net gain is zero. The money's just been shifted. So this is an interesting theory that's just coming out as to how McKenna is getting his billions more for education without actually raising taxes other than through the property tax swap.
What do you think, CR?
Well, October was a good month for Mitt Romney, of course, and it was a good month for Rob McKenna, and I think the two are related. I mean, as the sort of national mood kind of gave Romney a surge after that first debate performance, you see that showing up in states. I mean, the national ticket does affect local races, and Obama won by 17 percentage points here in 2008. If Romney can sort of keep that percentage lower, I mean, Romney's not going to win this state. It's a blue state. But if he can keep Obama at sort of 10 percentage points and not 17, well, that has a direct effect on local elections. I mean, Rob McKenna will sort of gain as Romney eats into some of that margin. And I think that's what you were seeing. I mean, Jay had quite an advantage really since July when you look at a lot of the polls. And that margin is sort of thinned. Then you have this Elway poll, which is the first that sort of flipped and showed Rob ahead. So something's happened to Jay in the last, you know, 6 weeks. I think he's still mostly ahead in all the polls, but that margin is narrowed. I think it does reflect part of the dynamic of the national Romney surge.
Do you think we're going to see a lot of ballot splitting, people voting for Obama and McKenna?
Absolutely. I mean, look at Luke Burbank. You know, the Cairo radio.
What about him?
Well, I mean, here's a guy who has said he's supporting McKenna. I mean, here's a sort of liberal guy that's supporting McKenna. You will have all kinds of ticket splitting. You always do in Washington. The question is how much. I mean, McKenna needs a lot of ticket splitting. And one thing that I'm sort of struck by talking to a lot of people about this race, sort of left, right, and center, there are a lot of kind of, you know, moderate to left leaning people that are going for McKenna. And I think Luke Burbank is kind of an example. I mean, I hear from a lot of those people. And so, you know, that's what Rob needs. He's not going to win with just Republicans in a state like Washington. He needs the sort of moderate left of center sort of ticket splitters. He's gotten those in the past when he's run for AG.
I would love to hear Luke explain this one, because the way I've heard him talk about his politics before does not really line up on a policy level with what McKenna is putting forward. But this is part of what the McKenna campaign is counting on, that people will sort of buy into the idea that he is an acceptable moderate without really laying down their policy beliefs next to McKenna's policy beliefs and seeing whether these policy beliefs actually match up on gay marriage, on reproductive rights, on any number of issues.
And Luke said he didn't agree on those issues, sort of social issues. He said, listen, I don't really side with him on abortion, gay marriage, and that kind of stuff, but I'm going to put that aside, and I'm going to sort of go with him based on the feeling about the state's economy.
So that's quite a lot to put aside. And then if, this has been debated quite a lot in the debates, but the economic questions are very important, too. And the candidates actually, although they superficially sound similar, do have very different policy proposals for the economy in the state, not the least of which is this property tax swap issue and how they're going to actually fund billions more for schools.
What do you think, Knute?
Well, one of the issues is this the governor's race of 2004, or the governor's race of 2008, in terms of both of which were the Dino Rossi on the Republican side and Christine Gregoire on the Democrat side. Dino Rossi came extremely close, within a handful of votes of winning.
129 and then 133, right?
And, I talked to Rob McKenna early on about what made him think he could sort of outdo Dino. And I think that certainly McKenna, if all things being equal, McKenna not only has held statewide office, but is a person of much more substance than Dino Rossi. So I think, there was always a sense that, he could at least match, if not do better. The way he has shaped his campaign, I believe, and I've been spending a lot of time, on the East Side talking with people about politics, is that, you have this phenomenon of people who are very socially progressive, sort of the Microsoft phenomenon, socially progressive, but skeptical of government, but not skeptical of government in the kind of I hate government, but skeptical in that this sort of sense, the Bill Gates sense of government is dumb. It's kind of dumb and inefficient. And that provides an opening for somebody like McKenna who can peel off people by just simply suggesting that, look, I'm progressive enough that my sort of better management skills and my willingness to kind of get things done on that side is going to appeal to a certain number of people. Likewise, I think Inslee, and I've said this before, I think he's running a very sort of suburban-focused campaign as well, trying to appeal to technological innovation, jobs, optimism. I really think it's going to come down to turnout. If the turnout for Obama is high enough, I think it could be a little bit more like 2008. If the turnout is not as strong, Kerry didn't do quite as well as Obama did, although he did very well in King County. But then you have the opportunity for the folks who are switching or splitting their boat, the McKennacrats is what I call them. You have a chance. I think it's anybody's race at this point. And as I said last week, I think the momentum is clearly a little bit with McKenna in that he's the one that's been moving up and up his numbers.
So a couple of thoughts here. The turnout, interestingly, Sam Reid predicted 81%, which I thought it was going to be 85 or 86, which is the high water mark. So that's one thing that people should keep their eyes on. Some of the younger voters who came out in big numbers for Obama in 2008 are probably not going to be there. They're not as enthused. One caveat on the Stuart Elway poll is something I've been tracking for some time, cell phone voters. Stuart used 9% of his total are cell phone only voters or cell phone voters, which is a low number because Survey USA, which didn't use cell phones for a long time, now has 25% cell phone voters. And Gallup recently upped theirs from 40% to 50%, when you're polling, you're going to get a different number based on that calculation, whatever number you decide that you're going to use. There was one other thing that happened this week nationally that I just thought, wow, this is really interesting, again, back to my fixation on female voters, and that is the Murdoch claims about rape. You remember, flashback to whatever month that was, when Todd Akin came out and had something ridiculous to say about rape and pregnancy. That imploded and was a big deal. But right now, the noise level in the election is so high that it's every strand comes in but is not. So, by that logic, Barack Obama should be benefiting from yet another silly thing that's said about rape. But not. It's just part of the noise right now. It's so noisy out there.
Yeah, it's hard to break through on any one issue. And it'll be interesting to see whether this, what seems like a very obvious push to get people to split their tickets in King County between Obama and McKenna, breaks through. I mean, we talked about this a few weeks ago when the owner of the Crocodile was paying for posters on Capitol Hill that were encouraging people to split their tickets this way. It's interesting that Luke Burbank is now encouraging people to split their tickets this way. One of the things that confounds me about people who are otherwise representing themselves as strong progressives supporting McKenna is how they can actually set aside their support for gay rights and reproductive rights in this context. I mean, they can say, well, I'm voting for R-74 and McKenna. But, and we've talked about this in the context of the Seattle Times ads also, which are for R-74 and Rob McKenna. Ideologically, this is nonsensical. I mean, McKenna does not support same-sex marriage. And we saw this year how important it is to have a governor in support of same-sex marriage. If same-sex marriage is not approved at the polls, which is not a far-fetched scenario. It's very close. We don't know. It will be very important to have a governor who supports same-sex marriage. So if you support same-sex marriage, I don't quite see how you're doing that by voting for a candidate who does not support it and would not as governor. And likewise with reproductive rights, there's no way to argue that McKenna is more progressive on reproductive rights than Jay Inslee. That's just not possible. They've really tangled over it. And McKenna will say that he's, I don't know if he would call himself pro-choice, but he tries to suggest that. But Inslee is way more progressive than McKenna on reproductive rights issues. And again, this is something that the governor for 4 years will have a huge say in. So it's just been very interesting to me to see people rationalize setting these things aside. I haven't heard the convincing argument.
Well, I just don't think a lot of voters have a strict ideological litmus test, especially at the state level for candidates. They can look at somebody and say, well, you know, I'm for gay rights. He's at least he's for, domestic partners. He said he'd follow the will of the voters if marriage equality passes. And, he seems like he'd be a better manager than Jay. I mean, that's a very reasonable position, I think, for somebody to take. I mean, it's I just think that where you draw that litmus test. I mean, people have other litmus tests, but I don't think that's necessarily how most people approach, particularly local offices.
Well, that may be, but I do think it ends up being ideologically nonsensical. I mean, you are working against your own interest. I don't see how you get around that.
Well, you might be working against one of your interests, but you might be working in favor of two or three others.
And then what you end up doing, and this is the interesting conversation that I actually feel like isn't had enough, what you're actually doing is ranking your interests. And so you are saying that what you perceive to be better management of the state, whatever that means, is more important to you than equal rights for gays and lesbians and full reproductive rights for women. I mean, that's what's happening there. It's a cold, calculated ranking of something called management above people's rights.
All right. On that note, let's take a break. That's Eli Sanders, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, associate editor of The Stranger, Knute Berger, editor-at-large for Seattle Magazine, Mossback at crosscut.com, C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News, and Joni Balter, assistant political editor for The Seattle Times. We'll be right back.
Clouds and rain, 50 degrees in Seattle's University District. Working towards a high of 52 today. We're expecting clouds and showers the rest of this afternoon. It's going to be cloudy and rainy tonight and tomorrow. Tonight's low, 47. Tomorrow's high, 54.
Support for KUOW comes from Soaring Heart Natural Sleep Company, handcrafting organic, chemical-free mattresses and pillows since 1982. Now offering yoga for sleep classes, Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. designed to improve sleep with gentle stretching and meditation before bed. All are welcome. More at SoaringHeart.com.
On one fateful night in 1938, thousands of men and women ran from their homes convinced that Martians were invading, all because of a radio play.
But there is one thing we must not overlook. All this took place in 1938, in a less sophisticated yesteryear.
Okay, were we really so unsophisticated back then? Could the War of the Worlds happen again? Here's a hint, yes. We'll find out on the next Radio Lab, where we'll come to you.
Live at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And that comes your way tonight at 7 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from Cupcake Royale, now featuring cupcakes decorated for Halloween and election parties, and the pumpkin cardamom made with local pumpkin. Cupcake Royale features natural, fresh, and local ingredients. Ordering information at cupcakeroyale.com.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. We're reviewing the news of the week with Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, and C.R. Douglas. And before we totally leave local politics behind, which maybe we'll never do during this hour,
leave
but we might,
politics behind.
Let's talk about what Chris Gregoire has been up to this week. One of the things she did was she warned her successor, either Jay Inslee or Rob McKenna, that neither one of them is going to be able to deliver on their campaign promises not to deliver taxes. She was essentially saying that she said the same thing, but now she knows better. And she also says that she's going to still support Jay Inslee, but she's issuing a warning. It's not going to happen. So why is she issuing a warning?
Well, because she's going to write a budget. And, you know, this is the delight of an outgoing governor. They get to go out and say, here's what I think. And also, don't forget, she's had these many years to try to balance this budget and knows that she feels, this is her argument, that she has been unable to find billions of dollars for education. I mean, they have squeezed this budget over and over again in her time. And she's saying, easy for her to say, if I were a governor, you know, in 2013, I would raise taxes. But she's on the way out. She's not facing an electorate. And yet she is still saying that and sort of daring them both, which has been, as we pointed out a couple times, one of the themes of this gubernatorial race is they're both saying that we're going to spend more on education and we're not going to raise taxes. And then the subtext is, I'm saying that, but the other guy, he's really tricking you. He's coming around to raise your taxes. It might be a property tax swap, or it might be some other part of his history in Congress. You know, Congress, dirty word. That Jay Inslee will do it because he has a pattern of it.
CR?
Well, the governor also, I think, feels like she takes responsibility for the current state of education. The Supreme Court ruling happened on her watch. A lot of this underfunding sort of accumulated over 8 years. So I think she feels like on the way out, it's her duty to offer a way to get that Supreme Court mandate fulfilled. And that's why she's suggesting this revenue increase. When you talk to people sort of on both sides, most people feel like it is unlikely to be able to fulfill that sort of Supreme Court mandate under either candidate's plan, as say McKenna's or Inslee's. I mean, the feeling that Inslee will sort of limit growth in the rest of the budget and therefore increase the share of education, the feeling is, can he really limit the growth in the other areas with a Democratic majority down in the House and Senate, which is likely to continue to stay there? Can he really do that? And can Jay Inslee really get enough jobs, you know, in the green economy to sort of grow our way to prosperity and fund education that way? I mean, there's a lot of grumbling on both sides that they can't do it under these sort of glossy plans they're each proposing, and that a revenue sort of source will be required.
Eli?
It's nice to hear Governor Gregoire saying that the math does not work other than to raise revenue, but it is so unfortunate that we haven't heard that from her until now. I mean, we've been on this panel for years dealing with this issue, and, you know, I am not alone in having been someone who brought up on this panel the need for more state revenue to deal with all kinds of funding problems, including education. And, you know, at the time, the governor and others, editorial boards and so on, said, you know, no, we can find more money somewhere else. And now the governor says that's false. Well, there's a lot of pain and a lot of harm created on the way to that admission. And now she's on her way out and saying it, fine. But the two candidates for governor are campaigning, you know, beneath this false assumption. And it's just it is an unfortunate state of events.
CR,
we can't talk about the truth until we're on the way out.
CR, you have something to add?
Oh, well, I believe she did support the income tax a few years ago, which would have gone to education. So point is well taken, but there was a...
But it was kind of late and too little.
Yeah.
Joni, did you want to add something?
No, I'm good.
Knut?
Well, I agree with the governor's analysis that they can't accomplish what they're saying they're going to accomplish only by the means that they've been willing to admit to. And I mean, I've said before, the lean government thing that Jay Inslee talks about, every governor, you know, since who knows when, has had that same type of program. Gregoire wanted to lean it. Inslee says he wants
priorities of government is what Gary Locke called it.
Gary Locke even gave a speech about paperclips at one point, you know, and Booth Gardner had his management by walking around thing. I mean, everybody brings in these sort of business school things, and I don't think it's unreasonable for people to be relatively cynical about whether that's going to work. And likewise, I think McKenna's plan of trying to shift funding to education. He's at least honest that they're going to have to be cuts or spending caps on other parts of state government. But the fact is, even with limited growth, there are parts that are not funded. I mean, they're nowhere near and funded adequately, and there's some huge problems coming up with things like parks and others that have essentially been written out of the budget that long-term ought not be the situation. So I think, I think Eli's right. It's just unfortunate that it's come to this.
No governor can control health care costs, and that is one of the, you know, the Pac-Men that attacks the state budget every year that just goes in and gobbles up whatever percentage it's increasing by.
Do you expect Gregoire to do anything, notable in her final months here? Anyone?
Well, the budget she proposes will be interesting. And I actually think there's a disagreement on the trail about who can control health care costs better. I mean, Inslee certainly has talked in the debates about McKenna's campaign against Obamacare and how that was not ultimately, if he'd been successful, was not going to help state health care costs. So I think they both do have ideas about how they're going to contain healthcare costs, and they're very different.
The other shoe to drop isn't Gregoire's. It's of course going to be how the Supreme Court decides on the 2/3 rule. Mm-hmm. And the new Iman initiative is ahead in the polls, indicating, you know, people are going to support putting it back in. So the question is whether that'll get overturned by the Supreme Court. That would have a potentially major effect if it did get overturned. It turned out that 2/3 had to be in the Constitution for it to be legal. That would free the hands of the legislature to make a lower bar for being able to raise revenues if needed. So that's a potentially significant thing that's coming up.
And not exactly a lower bar, but potentially just the actual bar rather than, you know, the inflated bar, which is what the people who say this measure is unconstitutional say. It will be really interesting to see whether the Supreme Court rules on this before the election.
I was just going to say, it looks like they're not going to do it.
Yeah,
they
issue their rulings on Thursdays, right? Is that right?
I don't know. I mean, I was at the oral.
Chance.
Well, I was at the oral arguments were just feels like just a couple weeks ago. They are unlikely to do this. I do think they will before the session,
yes.
Or certainly early in the session, so the legislature has time to react to do we need the 2/3 or not. I expect Iman's initiative will win. You know, we're back to sort of another 2/3 requirement on the ballot. But this idea that it would win by 64-65%, which it did in 2010, I think those days are over. I mean, you have some differences this year than then. I mean, first of all, the Seattle Chamber of Commerce has switched its view on the 2/3 majority. So I think that's changing. It's an example of sort of a bit of a changing, you know, plate here on this idea of should this hurdle be this high, has it start this?
And we'll show that if you say Iman, that has a bad effect after all these years. It used to be, you know, not a bad one at all.
I believe voters, again, will still vote for this, but I don't think it's going to be the margin it was 2 years ago, especially at the height of, you know, that was when people were most, first of all, a real blue wave or red wave, and people were very, very worried about pockets 2 years ago.
We should
less
say,
so now.
While we're talking about the Supreme Court and whether it will act before the election, while everyone is paying attention, right, they have a strong incentive not to, since they are all elected officials, for better and for worse. I mean, this is a system that a lot of people have been asking questions about in this state in recent years.
So before we run out of time, Eli, you were saying, going back to an issue we were looking at last week about the Seattle Times allowing full-page ads for Rob McKenna and in support of gay marriage, you liked their Truth Needle article this morning.
Yeah, and I should say, not just allowing, they are bankrolling these ads. That's the issue. The Seattle Times is paying $80,000 to fund full-page ads every day until the election for Rob McKenna, and roughly the same amount to put in ads for R74 for the Approve campaign. And people have been really alarmed about this. And there's, you know, the staff at the paper is really alarmed. There are 100-plus people who signed a letter to the publisher saying this undermines their credibility. So this morning, the Seattle Times staffers, two of them, Susan Kelleher and Linda Shaw, did a Truth Needle on their own company, on their owners, which is an unusual thing. The Truth Needle feature is where the Seattle Times usually fact checks other ads in the campaign, and then campaigns use them to discredit their opponents' ads. So it was really interesting, and I thought actually really wonderful to see the Seattle Times reporters truth squatting their own bosses.
What
really,
did they give it?
Well, it might.
Yeah,
yeah,
we should say
it might
give
it a half
finding.
They gave it a half.
Yeah, they found the ad half true, which is another way of saying half false, and also reminds you that then what is going on here is that a company that is in the business, allegedly, of putting out truthful information is paying to put out
half-truths,
half-false information or ads built on falsehoods in an effort to influence the governor's race in this state, which is quite amazing.
Knut?
Well, more fodder for the sort of train wreck, I think, of the decision to do what they did in political advertising. And I noticed that in the Truth Squad report, the Seattle Times spokesperson kept referring to the vendor wrote that, the vendor wrote this. Is, you know, they had obviously hired, whether it was an outside ad agency or an outside, but they wouldn't name who it was, and that struck me in the thing. It's sort of like, well, why don't you tell us where the information came from?
I do think... Well, I do think it shows that there is a firewall. I mean, all these people are worried that somehow, you know, the business side is going to infect the news reporting side. I mean, here's an example of, you know, they're true squatting their own business side. They're not controlled by, you know, the money people. I mean, the reporters are out there, you know, playing independent journalists.
Joni?
I thank you for that, because actually, you know, there are these divisions. It's hard to convince people sometimes, but the tweets, as the tweet said this morning, heralding that story, we really are independent, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because there's been a huge debate this week. If you go to the journalism websites or other websites around town or Facebook, about whether people should cancel their subscriptions or not. Mark Matassa, who is a former editor of the Seattle Times, he's at Crosscut too. He wrote a thing about why he was canceling his subscription, but the difficulty he had in canceling his subscription because apparently the people on the phones there trained not to minimize the cancel. It's very hard to cancel, let's just say.
I heard that
they're not going to let you.
2 week protest cancellation.
Right. You can have a protest cancellation. And so that's very interesting. But then you have other people. My new boss, Greg Shaw, Crosscut, wrote a thing about why he wasn't going to cancel. And I think, you know, part of the debate comes down. And in fact, Mark Matassa's sister, who also was an editor at the Times, took the opposite position. And so you had a sibling debate going on. But I think, you know, one of the rationales is, why should I send my money to support, support the Times, a business and journalistic enterprise that would do such a thing? And other people are saying, well, you don't want to hurt the reporters. You don't want to hurt the news gathering. And in fact, there is a lot of integrity there. And so it's this interesting discussion about, if you cancel your subscription, who are you hurting? Are you making things worse? Or are you making things better?
Well, and why are you canceling it? I mean, I didn't read Matassa's thing, but I mean, did he not like the McKenna endorsement or not like the R-74 endorsement?
Oh, I think he was uncomfortable with both.
The concept.
At the root. And I don't think it was a smack against the people in the newsroom, but it's perfectly legitimate to cancel a subscription based on the way a business conducts its business.
Yeah, that's
your version of a boycott.
Right.
Our boss, Dave Boardman, wrote a pretty compelling piece on Sunday urging people, to stay with us.
Right.
Because of that, we do independent journalism.
But you could also make the argument that you don't shop at Walmart, not because of the integrity of Walmart employees, but you don't like what the owners are doing overseas.
Right.
I mean, there are different ways you can cut that argument.
And I think this just underlines what a dangerous and unfortunate move this was for the owners of the Seattle Times to make. People can effectively understand the idea of the firewall between advertising and editorial and still feel like reasonably that their subscription dollars are being used to pay for an ad for a political candidate, which is not their intention. And so they can understand and believe in everything about the way the Seattle Times divides itself, but be concerned about that, which is, I'm amazed that the owners of the company took that risk that people would, end up perceiving that and start canceling.
We're almost out of time, so let's touch on something that's very lighthearted to end this, which is the vote is in, and the Space Needle is going to be covered in dark green and light green trees in the coming months.
There Skip drew that himself.
I personally,
as far as I know.
I would have had some moss hanging off.
I personally voted to keep it galaxy gold, but Skip, as the writer in residence, what do you think of the makeover of our Space Needle?
I should disclose I was part of the group that picked the six finalists. Didn't have any say in the final. That was a public vote. I don't think the Seattle Times weighed in with an ad either way. There were a bunch of great designs. This is the first time ever that the public has gotten to choose what color the Space Needle is, and it'll only be, I think, for 6 months until the April 21st of next year.
Do they go around again to figure out another color?
I think, the question is whether they're going to go back to the kind of neutral white color that it was before, or whether there are a lot of people, myself included, who would love to see it stay galaxy gold. So I'm hoping they'll go back to that color, but they so far the word I've heard is that they're going to go back to the neutral thing. But I what was really cool was to see all the entries. I mean, they're little kids, professional designers, Native Americans. It was just this incredible kind of outpouring of ideas, and many of the ones that had to be rejected had to do with kind of technical reasons. But people, it's just a wonderful sort of canvas on which people were projecting their image of the region, and it was I thought a really fun idea.
Was there a common theme in the entries?
No, there wasn't. I mean, some of the really funny ones sort of imagined that you were looking down on the Space Needle from a Seattle police drone or something.
Yes.
It looked like a pizza or a record disc or something. But that wouldn't translate because most people don't see the Space Needle looking down from the mast. They see it kind of looking up at an angle. But I think it'll be the first time the Space Needle's ever been green. I think that'll be fun to see what that's like.
All right, and we'll leave it there. That's Knut Berger, editor-at-large for Seattle Magazine, Mossback at crosscut.com. He's also author of Pugetopolis and Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Eli Sanders is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and associate editor at The Stranger. And C.R. Douglas is a political analyst for Q13 Fox News. Thanks all four of you for coming in.
Thank you.
Good Katie. To be here.
One more news and review before the election. Is that right? Two? One. One to go.
So. I will be here. I'll see you in a couple
weeks. I know.
Weeks.
So you'll be missing out on all the fun.
Can't take the heat.
Weekday is produced by Jason Pagano, Brian Buckaloo, Amina Alsadi, Alexander Garrettin, and Danielle Anthony Goodwin, our interns. Andy Hurst is engineering. I'm your host, Katie Sewell, sitting in for Steve Scher. Have a great weekend.
It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away.
Support for KUOW comes from the Overlake School in Redmond, providing a rigorous college prep curriculum and a wide range of arts and athletics for grades 5 through 12. Open house for grades 7 through 12, October 31st from 9 to 11:30 a.m. Reservations required. Details at overlake.org.
I can speed up and slow down the modulation.
On the next Fresh Air from the Archive, an interview with the late Robert Moog. A festival of electronic and visionary music in tribute to him takes place this weekend. Also from the Archive, an interview with John Cage. His work is the subject of international celebrations this year, marking the centennial of his birth. Join us.
That's tonight at 8 on our second program service, KUOW2.
Support for...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.